the year 1959, I was a deacon in the major seminary, still studying and waiting to be ordained a priest in May of 1960. The successor of Peter at that time was a man in his 80s called Pope John the 23rd. Many felt that the cardinals at the conclave had elected the elderly Pope John the 23rd simply to be a sort of caretaker of the church until the younger Cardinal Montini would be ready to succeed him, which he did at the next conclave and took the name Pope Paul VI. The year 1959 was the 100th anniversary of the death of St. John Vianney, the Curé of Ars. And so through 1959 until August of 1960, St. John Vianney was proclaimed as an outstanding example for all parish priests. In the year 2009, 50 years later, I was awaiting my golden jubilee as a priest in May of 2010, while again an 80-year-old Pope, Benedict XVI, was now the successor of Peter. The year 2009 being the 150th anniversary of the death of St. John Vianney, the Church again declared from June 2009 to June 2010 to be the year of the priest, with St. John Vianney held up as a model for priests to follow. On hearing these very similar facts, a very young person might conclude that nothing much happened or changed in the past 50 years. But any older person who has lived through these past 50 years knows the tumultuous changes that have taken place both in the church and in the world during this period of time. What brought about these changes? Pope John the 23rd did not consider himself as the church's caretaker. He insisted that we open up a few windows in the church and let some fresh air in. He proclaimed that the work of the renewal of the church by the First Vatican Council was never completed, since the council was interrupted and the work must be completed. Thus moved by the same Holy Spirit, who knew also what changes were about to happen in the modern world, Pope John the 23rd called for a second Vatican Council to rejuvenate, especially in a pastoral way, the church. In 1959, the reaction of the seminary faculty and the seminarians was from shock to disbelief. Some were even saying the Pope had gone senile. Shortly after the beginning of the council, John the 23rd, the Pope, he died. And the new Pope, Paul VI, had the difficult task of maintaining continuity with the past while allowing pastoral changes in the church which could help rejuvenate it, knowing that some changes may need to be corrected and or stopped later if proved not to be helpful. The council was intended to be more pastoral than dogmatic. The difficulty was that inside the church, some saw the council as an opportunity to challenge and question many of the church's teachings, especially in regards to moral practices. Their source of authority for change was not the Holy Spirit, but rather their constant refrain was in the spirit of Vatican II, and one should follow one's own conscience. The problem was people's conscience was being formed by the world and dissident theologians rather than by the magisterium and the teachings of Vatican II. The dissenters became theologians of the world, believing as progressive and modern whatever practice the world was proclaiming, and then they used their minds to try to justify it. The true theologian of the church believes the church's teachings and uses their minds to show that the beliefs of the church are reasonable or do not contradict reason. The river of renewal unleashed by the Holy Spirit in Vatican II to renew the church and the world was constantly being weakened by offshoots of dissent, not only against all sexual moral restraints inside and outside of marriage, but even such fundamental dogmatic teachings as the real, unique, substantial presence of Christ in the Eucharist was questioned or was watered down. Eventually, not only Eucharistic devotion and adoration was dismantled, but many devotional practices were also challenged or discouraged or dropped. These dissenters didn't accept the infallibility of the Pope because it conflicted with theirs. In Mass, the catechetical sermon was replaced by the homily on the scriptures. It seemed harmless, except within a decade, the younger generation in the church no longer understood or could explain or defend their faith. Thus, without a knowledge of their faith, the ways and values of a world without Christ slowly became more acceptable and attractive to them. Vatican II was not and is not the problem, but rather the rejection of Vatican II and the so-called spirit of Vatican II became the problem. Indeed, on the occasion of the 125th anniversary of the death of St. John Vianney, Pope John Paul II was going to Ars in France, where St. John Vianney was the curé. In 25 years, how radical a change had taken place. Well, the Pope was verbally attacked by many of his own priests in France for holding up to them an outdated saint for the modern priest. All of this dissent was a major tragedy because it was at the very time that the world needed a strong, united church to proclaim the truth without ambiguity because of the changes about to happen in the world. And what were some of those changes? In the year 1959, Americans were introduced to the chip and the pill. The chip, the size of a newborn's thumbnail, is the nickname for an integrated electronic circuit with a backbone of silicon, an ingredient of common beach sand. The chip was able to do a million calculations a second, while the old IBM computer in the 1950s, with its bulky vacuum tubes, which occupied a whole room, had a very limited capacity. The chip promised to provide the capacity to advance technological capacity in quantum jumps, with the potential to alter the lifestyles fundamentally by putting a computer or a microprocessor on a chip. For the most part, it has done so, and done it in a very positive fashion, from putting a computer on an individual's lap to help putting a man on the moon. Everything now is computerized, from cars to airplanes, and has made information accessible to millions without them leaving even their homes. The pill is the nickname given to the chemical contraceptive that the providers also promised would radically alter social behavior of peoples, especially in the family. It has, but in an incredible, disastrous manner. By deliberately blocking God's actions and the conception of a new life, it has changed the thinking of many people on the purpose of sex. The final purpose of sex is no longer a personal act of love, open to life, but rather the purpose of sex is pure pleasure, even to the exclusion of life. Pregnancy is no longer considered a blessing, but something to be feared and avoided at all cost, even by way of an abortion. The woman has become for many no longer a person to be loved, but a sex object to be used and even abused. It opened the door to unnatural acts being acceptable and approved by society, and laboratory reproduction being applauded and funded. It provides governments with ways to control forcefully their population. The negative effects have been monumental. The Church Fathers in Vatican II, in a document on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, reaffirmed its constant teaching that to obstruct life in the marriage act or to destroy the product of the act afterwards is intrinsically wrong. Pope Paul VI said he would decide whether the new chemical pill taken before the act was to be considered also a contraceptive and therefore morally unacceptable. That is all he was deciding. The secular media, however, urged on by dissenters in the church, gave the impression the Pope was trying to determine if the use of all contraceptives would be okay. In May 1960, the contraceptive pill, whose distribution in America was still illegal, was distributed under the cover of being a health product that would correct a woman's irregular menstrual cycle. And suddenly in America, 1 million women had irregular cycles that needed to be corrected and healed. The women were not told about the incredible negative side effects of the pill on the woman's body. And finally, on June 7th, 1965, the United States Supreme Court, in the decision Griswold versus Connecticut, legalized the pill for married people in the privacy of their homes. And so on that same day, June 7th, 1965, a nurse called Griswold, working for Planned Parenthood, distributed the first legal contraceptive pill in America. Pope Paul VI became the first pope to visit America when he arrived in New York City to address the United Nations on the afternoon of October 4th, 1965. This was only 4 months after the pill had been legalized in the United States, namely on June 7th, 1965. In the great UN Assembly Hall, Paul VI, in French, gave his famous talk to all the nations of the world about no more war, war never again. He received constant applause in the first two-thirds of his talk about peace and war never again. And then everything changed. When the Pope, to the surprise of the United Nations members, the media, and many other pushing for church to change its position on contraceptives, said, I quote, "The life of man is sacred. No one may dare offend it. Respect for life, even with regard to the great problem of the birth rate, must find here in your assembly its highest affirmation and its most recent defense. You must strive to multiply bread so it suffices for the tables of mankind, and not rather favor an artificial control of birth, which would be irrational, in order to diminish the number of guests at the banquet of life." End of quote. By evening, the media halted the praise of the Pope. The Pope, knowing that the poor and the undeveloped countries were the target of the population-controlled people, who favored giving bread to the poor only if the poor used contraceptives, given to them with a loaf of bread. And so the Pope in 1967, he issued his encyclical populorum progressio, the progress of people, in which he stressed the spiritual nature and uniqueness of each person must be taken into account for any true development of peoples. Otherwise, the Pope said, we will not be involved in a true development of humanity, but in inhumane humanism. So it was no surprise, considering his statement to the United Nations in 1965, his encyclical in 67, on the true development of peoples, that on July 25, 1960, the Pope, in his encyclical Humanae Vitae, clearly upheld the Church's teachings about the sacredness of marriage and affirmed that the use of contraceptives during the marital act and before it, by way of the chemical pill, were equally intrinsically evil. No longer could anyone say the teaching is not clear. So they attacked the Pope's authority and the reality of the natural law. And they proclaimed the sacredness of a person's individual conscience. Wrong is wrong, even if everyone is wrong. And right is right, even if everyone is wrong. Although the arguments against contraceptives in the beginning were abstract and academic, Pope Paul VI in section number 17 in Humanae Vitae, he ominously prophesied in concrete language what would happen if the teaching of the Church was to be rejected in 1968. The teaching was rejected by millions. And unfortunately, the negative effects predicted in section 17 are now a reality. The culture of death was now firmly established, with its tree of death being firmly implanted with its many deep and long roots. The roots of the tree of death are technological, scientific, and some knowledge of these roots is important to understand how to uproot them. Thomas Malthus, a pessimistic minister and economist, in 1798, he published in England his famous essay on the principles of population as it affects the future improvement of society. He studied population statistics and agricultural production and concluded that unless the birth rate were drastically reduced, the food supply would be unable to sustain the growing population and mankind would be doomed to pestilence, famine, and death. On the other hand, with an outright irony, for Malthus, famines, plagues, natural disasters was nature's way of controlling the population of the poor and should not get and we should not get in nature's way with misguided charity. Direct relief by the rich to the poor only made matters worse. It would also encourage larger families and laziness. None of Malthus's dire predictions proved true during his lifetime or since. Yet the Malthusian theory of overpopulation to this day has influenced many rich population control peoples and the public policy of most governments. Rather than expressly telling the poor to drop dead and not to have children, they do it in a more subtle fashion by tying to the aid we give to the poor the requirements of limiting their families by the contraceptives given to them with the loaf of bread. Now abortion, sterilization has been added to the package, and euthanasia will not be far behind. The British naturalist, Charles Darwin, he published his Origin of Species in 1859. After his research in Galapagos Islands led him to the belief that all species are formed through a gradual process of evolutionary change and that the survival or extinction of organisms depended on a process of natural selection. Darwin said he owed a debt to Malthus and was influenced by Malthus' view on population. Yet Darwin, in the beginning, did not apply his theory to the social or political sphere, but a Victorian biologist and philosopher called Herbert Spencer, who lived from 1820 to 1903, he was quick to do so. Spencer created social Darwinism by applying the idea of evolution to social circumstances and claiming that by the competitive process, society removes its inferior elements and only the fittest survive and the unfit are removed and progress is made. Like Malthus, Spencer was opposed to the passing of any laws to help the poor, or even subsidizing social programs to help the poor, but rather steps should be taken to prevent the unfit from propagating. Spencer said, just as nature weeds out the unfit, an enlightened society ought to weed out the unfit and permit them to die off so as not to weaken the racial stock. Sir Francis Galton, 1822 to 1911, a writer, sociologist, a cousin of Darwin, was a social Darwinist and the father of the pseudoscience of eugenics, namely a good birth. Galton, in his book, Hereditary Genius, expressed his belief that a man's character and capabilities was primarily shaped by heredity, and therefore the present generation had the power to improve the inborn qualities of future generations by actively weeding out or discouraging the breeding of those who Galton considered inferior, which for him was obviously the poor, those physically different, like black people, or naturally morally corrupt, like the Jews. He naturally argued for the sterilization of the feeble-minded, the criminal, the insane, as necessary to reduce the population of the unfit. Indeed, Darwin, in his work The Descent of Man, incorporated quotes from the Galton's book Hereditary Genius. Obviously, the goals of eugenics is to check the birth rate of the unfit, to bring about the improvement of the race by the productivity of the fit, and only that amount which can be properly cared for. Galton based his conclusions on simplistic ideas and generalizations, and like Malthus and Spencer, had an incredible tendency to accept sweeping generalities while ignoring well-established and proven medical and biological data. In spite of the shoddy scholarship, the so-called educated elite and the rich tycoons in Western society, like James Hill, the railroad tycoon, Andrew Carnegie, the steel tycoon, John D. Rockefeller, the oil tycoon, they quickly, scandalously embraced these Malthusian ideas coming through Spencer and Galton. This scientific racism was more acceptable than a simple ethnic racism based on emotions and hate. Besides considering themselves among the so-called fit, it obviously made them feel good about themselves. It provided them with justification why others should leave the planet Earth and not themselves. The first International Congress of Eugenics was held in London in 1912. Among the 800 participants at the Eugenics Congress were the most prominent scientists, social scientists, politicians, and prominent intellectuals. In 1921 and 1932, the International Congress was held in New York City, and again well attended by the intellectual and scientific elite. Now that the theory was acceptable on the highest levels, the next step was who and how to apply it. The eugenics movement grew strong in England and was strongly embraced in America and Germany, where the eugenicists for both countries worked hand in hand together. As a matter of fact, Leon Whitney, the late of the American Eugenics Society, sent his book, The Case for Sterilization, to Adolf Hitler and received back a personal letter of thanks from the Führer. The racist Madison Grant sent the Führer a copy of his book, The Passing of the Great Race, and also received back a personal letter from Adolf Hitler, who proclaimed that this book was his Bible. Under Hitler, eugenic ideas became the foundation of the organization of a whole state, which was looked upon with approval both in England and America. Indeed, a number of American eugenicists visited and were welcomed in Germany, such as Lothrop Stoddard, who wrote The Rising Tide of Color Against the White World Supremacy. He expressed his support with how the Nazis were weeding out the worst strains in the German stock in a scientific way from the Third Reich. Not only were his writings featured in Nazi school textbooks, but Lothrop met with Heinrich Himmler, the chief of the SS, and even had a personal meeting with Adolf Hitler. After World War II, the revelation of the Nazi atrocities hindered but did not crush the eugenics movement. It soon returned in a more insidious forms, especially with Margaret Sanger of America and her deadly offspring, the International Planned Parenthood, and Maria Stopes of England and her deadly offspring, Maria Stopes International, thus supplying new ways to implement the eugenics program on a grander scale. Margaret Sanger was born in 1879, and she became aware of Malthus from her radical free-thinking father and was converted to the principle of the sexual revolution to liberate women from sexual bondage through the influence of Emma Goldman, a militant utopian in France. She met many prominent Malthusians, eugenics supporters like H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw, and the sexologist Havelock Ellis. Eugenics gave her control, gave her scientific grounds to justify her radical sexual liberation views and to argue for birth control and to emancipate women from the family. In 1917, she founded a magazine called the Birth Control Review that featured articles of prominent eugenicists and utopian friends like H.G. Wells, Pearl Buck, Julian Huxley, Havelock Ellis. It caught the attention of the intelligentsia. Sanger, in her plan for peace, advocated segregating the country's million of unfit onto farms where they would receive adequate care like forced sterilization and birth control to protect the fit citizens from them. In 1922, Sanger revealed her strong scientific racist bent in her book, The Pivot of Civilization, where she presents birth control, sterilization, abortion as the way to solve social problems. Of course, today she would include euthanasia. She spoke against the cruelty of charity. She said that the most serious charge that can be brought against modern benevolence is that it encourages the perpetuation of defectives, delinquents, and dependents. These are the most dangerous elements in the world community, the most devastating curse on human progress and expression. She was repulsed by the poor working class created by the Industrial Revolution, and who in her eyes were possibly worse than the subhuman Negro. In the 1930s, Sanger wrote an article entitled a code to stop overpopulation of children. Some of the ways expressed in the article to purify the human race was to agree that a marriage license would not include the right to have children. One would need a permit to have children, issued only to couples if they met the qualifications decided by others. Obviously, the feeble-minded, the habitual criminals, those with inheritable diseases, the biologically unfit, they should be sterilized and isolated. With a religious zeal, she set out to implement her ideas. In 1914, she founded the American Birth Control League. In 1925, in New York City, she held the International Neo-Malthusian and Birth Control Conference, at which she gained the complete support of those involved in birth control and eugenics. In the 30s, Sanger sought and obtained corporation grants, foundation bequests, and endorsement of well-known celebrities and politicians such as Katharine Hepburn, Eleanor Roosevelt, from Rockefeller to Henry Ford, and later on even Presidents Truman and Eisenhower. She secured the backing of rich disciples of Malthus like the Fords, the Mellons, and the Rockefellers to fund her birth control league. Her first birth control clinic was opened in a poor area of Brooklyn, New York. In 1939, in America, she undertook her first very successful Negro project. Birth control clinics were set up in areas of high concentration of African Americans, and the purpose of the clinics was to radically diminish the number of blacks. Gifts were given to black ministers to encourage the black people to use the birth control clinics. The Negro project was incredibly successful. Even today, Planned Parenthood still runs abortion clinics in many of these same areas, with the result that today a massive genocide of the black African Americans continues. For example, today in the borough of Brooklyn, where Sanger opened her first birth control clinic, the rate of abortions of black unborn babies, according to the 2008 New York State Vital Health Statistics, is the scandalous statistic that out of every 100 black unborn babies in the womb, 70 will be killed while still in the womb by abortion, with the government paying for at least 80% of them with taxpayers' monies. It's a tragic irony that many blacks in leadership positions in America are still outspoken in their support and funding of Planned Parenthood, showing that the so-called Negro Project in 1939 is still successful. In 1942, Margaret Sanger changed the name of the Birth Control League to Planned Parenthood, Federation of America. In 1948, the Federation became the International Planned Parenthood, for the goal was now no longer simply the unborn babies in Brooklyn, but indeed throughout the whole world. To accomplish this mission, the Margaret Sanger Research Bureau financed the development of the birth control pill. Furthermore, to accomplish this worldwide mission, Sanger needed the involvement of the United States government and other governments, the United Nations, and a massive conversion of the populace. How did this come about, and who helped her? John D. Rockefeller III, one of the richest men in the world, being the great-grandson of the oil tycoon, was a strong believer in the ideas of Malthus. And out of his own funds, he set up, with the help of Frederick Osborne, the well-known eugenicist, the New Population Council in 1952. He built a global network of population experts who worked to increase the supply of contraceptives to undeveloped countries. He constantly lobbied to get the United States government to become involved and join the population control forces. He would not have succeeded without the propaganda crusade of a man called Hugh Moore. Hugh Moore was the owner of the multi-million-dollar Dixie Cup Company, was an enthusiastic convert to Malthusian thinking. And after World War II, playing on the fears of people about the atomic bomb, he inundated politicians and important people in particular, and the public in general, with his pamphlets entitled The Population Bomb. In 1968, the ecologist and butterfly expert Paul Ehrlich published his book, The Population Bomb, taking the title from Moore's pamphlets. Ehrlich's book was filled with dire Malthusian predictions of what was going to happen to the world between 1970 and the year 2000 if it did not radically reduce the number of peoples. The secular media gave great coverage and credence to the book, The Population Bomb. In 1981, Julian Simon, a professor of economics, published his well-documented book entitled The Ultimate Resource, namely Man and His Imagination. He documents how every one of the gloom and doom theories of Ehrlich on energy, food, raw materials, pollution, standard of living, population itself, are either not well-founded or already proven to be false. He suggests that additional population actually leads to improvement of economic well-being. Recently, Pope Benedict XVI, in his encyclical Caritas in Veritate, he struck the same note, the same theme, by declaring that depopulation was a real cause of the present global economic recession. The Pope also wisely stresses that this ever-independent world, that any attempt of global governing to resolve world problems must allow at the same time real subsidiarity, independence among nations to maintain their own values. Otherwise, a worldwide state of tyranny is more likely to become a reality. Obviously, Julian Simon's scholarly work, The Ultimate Resource, received limited publicity from the media and the population control organizations. William Draper, a friend of Hugh Moore, was appointed by President Eisenhower to chair a committee on foreign aid. The Draper Report in 1959 became the first official United States government report to endorse population control in the context of foreign aid. With pressure from both Moore and Rockefeller, the United States Foreign Assistance Act of 1961 was passed and enshrined the Malthusian doctrine as the official United States policy. They convinced enough members of Congress that growing populations was also a threat to United States national security, and therefore aid should only be given to those countries that control their population. In 1975, President Gerald Ford accepted the plan set forth in Henry Kissinger's National Security Study Memorandum 200, which urges to use control of food resources to control foreign population. Thus, American aid was no longer about feeding the poor and the hungry, helping the sick, and improving the economic conditions, but rather the implementing of the Malthusian idea of reducing fertility in the undeveloped countries. This new policy was implemented on a large scale in 1966 when the United States Office of Population created USAID, the United States Agency of International Development, and appointed Dr. Ravenhold, a fervent Malthusian, to be its director until the year 1979. Like Margaret Sanger, he was convinced both birth control was the key to public safety, freedom from hunger, the way to development. The Office of Population under him shipped billions of condoms, abortifacient birth control pills, the IUD, to the areas of the world populated by the unfit. The director, Ravenhole, gave enormous funds to International Planned Parenthood and to Population Council to carry out Ravenhole's family planning population control program. One wonders to this very day whether Planned Parenthood really has to lobby for government grants, or is the United States government still implementing the Malthusian policy of giving hundreds of millions of dollars each year to these organizations who have the infrastructure in the countries and places where the unfit live. Using these organizations disguises from the average citizen what the government is unfortunately really about in their so-called development programs. The final pieces were finally put into place when, under President Johnson's administration, the United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution by unanimous vote that called for special aid for governments who were willing to make efforts to decrease their population. In 1967, the United Nations Fund for Population Activities, also known as the Population Fund, was established. It was to be funded by voluntary contributions from countries that support birth control to be the way to control population. In 1968, President Lyndon Johnson appointed Malthusian Robert McNamara as president of the International Bank for the Reconstruction, also known as the World Bank. And suddenly the main goal of the World Bank's foreign aid was to control population. When President Bush, around 2003, became informed and convinced that United Nations Population Fund was involved in the recent coercive population policy on the people in China, he immediately shut off U.S. funds to the organization. Unfortunately, President Obama, shortly after his election, quickly gave again the Population Fund millions of United States dollars to continue the Malthusian work. Uprooting the culture death would seem almost humanly impossible when one realizes that not only does the United States government and other governments fund these Malthusian organizations of death, but that their support comes also from powerful Malthusian-driven foundations like the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Buffett Foundation, William and Flora Hewlett, the Fords, the Zorros, the Turner, the MacArthur and Mellon Foundations. Having uncovered for you the economic, sociological, and eugenic roots of the culture of death, may I briefly unearth for you some important legalistic, juridical, and philosophical roots of this tree of death. The population control Malthusian scientists were anxious to implement the eugenic goals of a massive scientific eugenic cleansing of the human race by weeding out the unfit in their reproductive labs. The scientists were confident that the computer chip's impact on technology and the use of this technology in the area of biochemical sex sciences made the screening out of the genetically imperfect a reachable goal. Furthermore, the scientists were convinced not only could they remove the unfit, but they could actually improve the future stock of the human race through their experimentation on life in the same laboratory lab, reproductive labs, by way of embryo stem cell research, human cloning, etc. However, there were two inconvenient truths that needed to be negated or removed before their brave new world could be fully realized. And what were these truths? The truths were the absolute sacredness of each human life and the uniqueness of traditional family. They knew to attack directly either the absolute sacredness of life or the uniqueness of family would be foolish. Indeed, in the United States Declaration of Independence, The founding fathers declared that certain truths are so self-evident that no one would dare to argue against them. Namely, that the truth that an innocent person's right to life is absolute since it comes directly from God the Creator. The signers of the Declaration declared that no government, no court, no person has the right to take another innocent human person's life from them. And any government that would attempt to do so would lose all grounds for its authority, which authority comes from the God who gives the life. Moreover, it was common accepted wisdom amongst the people of all nations that a wise government should support and strengthen family life. For as the family goes, so goes society. The question was how to get such a radical change of ideas. Ideas are important, especially philosophical ideas. For everyone knows to sow an idea is to reap an act. And to repeat an act is to sow a habit. And to sow a habit is to reap a character, or a culture, or a civilization. Good ideas result in a good character, or a culture of life. Whereas bad ideas result in a bad character, or a culture of death. Our Lord said, "By their fruits you shall know them." A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. By their fruits you shall know ultimately which is a culture of life and which is a culture of death. The philosophical ideas or theories of the 18th and 19th centuries on the origin of society, on truth and freedom, on materialism and socialism and communism gained wide acceptance both in Europe and the United States and also helped pave the way for the growth of the culture of death in the 20th and 21st century. Thomas Hobbes, 1588 to 1679. He held that the origin of the state is simply a result of a collective contract inspired by self-interest and enforced by the power of the majority. Furthermore, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712 to 1778, in his social contract theory, he claimed all contracts, all society, are a result of the exchange of the will of two or more peoples. And every contract can be declared terminated if it is clear one or both parties no longer wills it. Thus, a judge can declare whether either party has withdrawn his or her will and therefore the marriage contract no longer exists. For Hobbes and Rousseau, the idea that the state exists because God made man a social being and the society of marriage exists because God made man male and female, and therefore what God has joined together, man must not separate, was no longer relevant or even acceptable. Thus, the societies of the state and marriage being man's creation, man could agree to change at will its rules and its laws. A practical atheism was taking roots. The thinking of Hobbes and Rousseau on society is obviously helpful in attacking people as prejudice against homosexual unions, who support traditional marriage as God's creation, with no equal, and the only place where human life should be conceived. They realized, insisting that all human life should be conceived only as a result of an act of love in the context of the traditional family, would put a full stop to the laboratory reproduction of humans. One of the most influential philosophers was Auguste Comte, 1798 to 1857, the father of French positivism. According to Comte, the human mind passes through three stages. The theological stage, trying to explain facts by supernatural agents. The metaphysical stage, seeking abstract reasons or verbal explanations. And finally, to the positive stage, which holds strictly to real data, namely to the order of observable cause and effect. For Comte, the positivist, reality existing beyond observable facts must be viewed at best with an agnostic attitude. Obviously, this resulted in the glorification of the mathematical, physical, and biological sciences as the only source of real and certain knowledge. In England, John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873. He applied the principle of positivism to all areas, including logic, psychology, and ethics. Quickly, the principles of positivism were applied to evolution by people such as Herbert Spencer. Positivism became the philosophy of the materialist. Since the existence of God can only be arrived at through reason, and the mind was no longer capable or considered a reliable instrument to truth, to arrive at truth, then God and faith beliefs must be excluded from the public square. Besides, since so many wars in Europe were religious in origin, instead of rightly saying that the state should not establish a religion, they insisted instead that the state should exclude God and the practice of any religion in the public square. In correcting one error, they created a greater evil, for a society without God is seriously detrimental to all living in it. And so by the end of the 19th century, God and faith was dethroned. By the end of the 20th century, reason too being rejected, truth was dethroned. And now only a secular society was acceptable where God and truth must be excluded. The dialectical idealism of theses, antitheses, and antithesis and synthesis of George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, 1770 to 1811, and the diametrically opposed philosophers Ludwig Feuerbach, 1804 to 1872, and Louis Buchner, 1824 to 1899, who popularized a strict materialistic view of life, were incredibly merged by the thinking of Karl Marx, 1818 to 1883, and Friedrich Engels, 1820 to 1895. And Lenin was soon forcefully setting up a socialistic, communistic society based on the dialectical materialism and atheistic ideas found in the works Das Kapital and Communist Manifesto, written by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. In this godless society, man exists for the state, and not the state for man. By removing the creator from the picture, of the devaluation of man was inevitable. In the reproductive labs today, where practical atheism reigns, God being excluded, human life in the labs is once more devalued and enslaved, but this time by modern, progressive, high-tech totalitarianism. The secular state and the atheistic scientist will remake this world in their image and likeness. In the culture of death, man's thinking is immanent. That is hubristic. Sinless man is turned in on himself, seeing no need for God or a savior to resolve problems or bring about progress. Philosophically, everything now seemed to be in place for the brave new world of the genetically cleansing of the human race. The concept that something is right or wrong, whether it be legal or not, was discarded. Now, using a positivistic approach, something is wrong because it's illegal, but if you change the law, it's right. So people will accept whatever we legalize, whether it be divorce, contraceptives, even abortion itself. Rightness and wrongness, namely truth, is separated from freedom. Freedom is now the absolute value, since a universal and objective truth arrived at by the mind is not reachable and therefore must not be imposed on all through the law. This thinking is the triumph of ethical relativism. Dr. Martin Luther King, and the great civil rights leader in America, said that the law cannot make you love me, but the force of the law must make you respect me. Remove the law, and the weak are at the mercy of the strong. And no one is weaker than the unborn infant. The unborn child's last hope for life is the law. And suddenly, on January 22, 1973, in America, that last hope for life, the unborn, was removed, because the law no longer protected God's precious infants in the wombs of their mothers. For suddenly in America, everything was radically changed overnight. When on that day, January 22, 1973, the United States Supreme Court, in an act of judicial tyranny, the judges legislated from the bench by handing down the infamous Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in America through the 9 months of the pregnancy. It was not only the death knell for the unborn, but it was the end of Western civilization. It was not whose culture was founded on the belief in God as creator and was rooted in the principle of Judeo-Christian ethics. By that decision, the quality of a person's life now became the absolute value, while one's right to life became relative to the quality of one's life as determined by others. There was never a question of when life begins, but rather has the quality of a person's life reached such a level as to make that person's life worth living. A decision not to be determined by the unborn, nor the chronically elderly sick, nor the Down syndrome child, or the handicapped person, but by others, who after making the decision are free to choose whether to end the other person's life or not. Obviously, euthanasia, where the quality of a person's life has lessened, was always included in the reasoning used in the decision to permit elective abortions. Although most citizens were shocked by the Supreme Court decision, yet the eugenics-driven positivistic thinking birth control movement quickly disposed people to accept the judicial decision on abortion as legal and therefore okay and a reasonable backup to any contraceptive failure, with the same reasons being used to justify both. Clearly, those in the racist eugenic movement are now completely convinced that the victory is complete and there is no way the people of life can turn it back. Why otherwise would they have placed about 6 weeks ago on the front page of the sports section of the New York Times newspaper a posed picture which would have 50 years ago caused a reaction by the readers close to a riot? The caption over the picture was, "A dream deferred almost too long." In the picture, there was three attractive women who obviously had just visited the beauty parlor to prepare for this posed picture. The excuse of putting them on the sports pages was because they were retired professional tennis players. But the real reason they put them into the paper was because they exemplified that people, including sports celebrities, had completely embraced the brave new world of the culture of death. In the picture, two women were seated, while a third woman stood between them but slightly behind them. Each of the women seated held a baby on her lap. The baby were twins. All were smiling. And looking at the picture, I said to myself, wait a minute. There's no way you can connect the dots and make moral sense out of this picture. The reason was because there was no visible man in the picture. The women were actually lesbian lovers who were unsuccessful in their adoption efforts. So they went the route of in vitro fertilization. Yet they still were without success because their eggs were defective. Their friend in the background finally donated her egg, and after two women perused the profiles of the men in the sperm bank, they finally decided on a genetically fit father. After making their choice, the sperm was used to fertilize her friend's egg, and then finally the zygote was implanted in the womb of the woman, who was obviously not the biological mother, but in reality a surrogate mother. Over the picture, I would have changed the caption from "a dream deferred almost too long" to the caption, "a nightmare realized all too soon." Instead of a riot from their readers viewing the picture, they expected no reaction from their readers, and sadly they seem to have been right in their judgment. Pope Paul VI, in section 42 of Populorum Progressio, said, What must be aimed at is a complete humanism. And what is that, if not the fully rounded development of the whole man and all of all men? A humanism closed in on itself, not open to the values of the spirit and to God, who is their source, could achieve apparent success. True, men can organize the world apart from God, but without God, man can organize in the end only to man's detriment. An isolated humanism is an inhumane humanism. There is no true humanism but that which is open to the absolute and is conscious of vocation which gives human life its true meaning. Far from being the ultimate measure of all things, man can only realize himself by reaching beyond himself. As Pascal said so well, man infinitely surpasses man. In my closing remarks, may I simply say that the present complacency of the eugenics populist control advocates is not well-founded, because there are so many sound reasons to hope that in spite of the long roots of the tree of death, it will definitely be uprooted, and the tree of life will once again blossom, and a culture of life will be restored. For time is on the side of truth, and with the passing of time, it has become clear, even to the past buyers, that the produce being sold from the tree of death are beyond rotten. The deadly produce is not only causing death to the weak and dependent, but grief and sorrow to the strong who survive. Obviously, the product can't sell itself, but will still need massive, deceptive advertising to convince any new buyers to buy it. Many who have purchased it in the past will not recommend it to others. Others publicly condemn it. Indeed, many of those living in the so-called undeveloped world who are considered unfit to breed, their eyes are now opening, and they can clearly see the hook of death attached to the demonic aid, and so are refusing to bite such a deadly loaf of bread. Where there is no offspring, there is no life, there is no future. In correcting the so-called problem of overpopulation, the population control advocates have been insanely involved in an overkill, so that if there is any population problem in the world today, it is not population explosion, but implosion. Just recently, Pope Benedict XVI wisely pointed out in Caritatis Veritate that depopulation is clearly one of the causes of today's worldwide recession, financial recession. Besides, these physicians of death have committed a major mistake, since they performed their death operation on the wrong patient, namely on the fit, who according to them should breed rather than the unfit who should not breed. Today, the 60 richest countries in the world all have a dying population. Their nations are below the replacement level to survive as a nation. Everyone in Western Europe, including now the governments, know that if the Muslim families who have, for the most part, rejected the culture of death were not having children, Europe would become a wasteland by 2050. The first steps in resolving a problem is to recognize that there is a problem. Both individuals and governments are becoming more reluctant to subsidize their own or their nation's death. The ancients believed in fata, namely the fates. Fata comes from a Latin deponent verb, for fari fatus, which means to speak. The past participle fatus, which means that which has been spoken. For the ancients, it was madness to act against the fates, namely that rational force guiding an ordered universe or cosmos. For them, man's reason enabled him to participate in this force. For the good pagans, when a man separated his freedom from truth, then such a man was driven by irrationality, or furor, or madness, and became destructive of self and others, and must be checked by the law. For the Romans, they believed that their greatest gift to posterity to maintain civilization was the gift of a reasoned law. We too believe the eternal plan of an intelligent God guides this universe, and our reason enables us to participate. in the mind of God and to bring God's eternal plan to completion. Rational man knows that there's more to the world than only what you can learn from the senses or the experiential sciences. But God has given us a further light called faith, by which we can know and participate in the eternal plan of God to bring all mankind into unity and perfection with the triune God through the death and resurrection of Jesus, the Father's only beloved Son, who is the merciful Savior of a fallen humanity. And that eternal plan of God is being worked out, is being brought to perfection. Or as the prophet Habakkuk reminds us, in the face of great evil, the Lord said to him, "Write down the vision clearly upon the tablets so that one can read it readily. For the vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and will not disappoint. If it delays, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not be late." We must have hope in the resurrection, even in the midst of our own passion. As the closing words of the book of the prophet Habakkuk reminds us, when the prophet says, "For though the fig tree blossom not, nor fruit be on the vines, though the yield of the olive fail and terraces produce no nourishment, though the flocks disappear from the fold and there be no herd in the stalls, yet will I rejoice in the Lord and exult in my saving God." For each of us then, our job at this Congress is to learn, we'll be reminded once again, what is the vision of God? Live the vision and proclaim courageously the vision to all the world. Our ultimate reason for hope then, in the face of great evil, is ultimately knowing we are doing God's will and God's will be done. The vision will be fulfilled. Amen.